It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, and today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a world of accordions has a home here in Wisconsin. We'll pay a visit to the Superior-based museum.
First, on May 27th of this year, immigration agents in Milwaukee conducted a raid across immigrant neighborhoods in the city, detaining 21 people.
The Department of Homeland Security said the raid was aimed at breaking up street gangs and arresting illegal immigrants with serious criminal records. This is part of an ongoing operation in which 200 immigrants have been identified.
Manuel Lopez was one of the people detained. His family, along with a handful of others, protested outside of Milwaukee's Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office this morning, asking for his release.
Christine Newman-Ortiz is executive director of Voces de la Frontera. She joined that protest. She joins us now to talk about it. Christine, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
And we have Manuel Lopez's daughter on our other line, Destiny Lopez. Destiny, hello.
Hi.
So, Christine, let's start with you picking up the story on May 27th. What prompted the arrests of these undocumented immigrants in Milwaukee?
Well, we know that over last couple of years that immigration has at times will move beyond its more individualized detentions, which often occur at people's homes. We've seen an increase, as folks know, at in the courtrooms in Wisconsin. And but then at times they do kind of a larger sweep, and this was one of those. And over the years, we've always known that when they do these sweeps, they put out their public press releases and really label people as hardened criminals. And aren't we all, safer that they're all behind bars, and that kind of characterization and mischaracterization. And so one of the benefits that Voces has is that it's a resource for families who've been impacted by deportations to come and seek help. And once we have families who come, and half of those families of the 21 we've had contact with, we're able to really know the facts and really make that public and expose a lot of the justifications. Because what's really driving this is that Congress has a mandate that immigration has to detain 34,000 immigrants a day to fill beds, detention beds. So in terms of the priorities around public safety are not being respected, because they have this arbitrary mandate that if they want to keep receiving federal dollars, they have to go do this. And so this last dragnet really exemplifies, again, some of the criminalization of immigrants that we're seeing. So in the case of, like, this last one, five of those cases, the 21 immigration said were gang-associated. The other 16 were immigrant violations. But even in the cases where they say gang association, you have folks who, like in two of those cases, we know, it went back to when the person was a young person, like 13, 14 years old, and this was like 14, 17 years ago, and that individual turned their lives around. They're, working adults now, loving fathers, husbands, and are providing honorably for their family. And so we've saw in this last round a lot of this kind of retroactive searching to take people, and this kind of activity doesn't provide any public safety at all. It undermines public safety.
Christine, I just wanted to ask, since our time is limited, what was the goal of this morning's protest?
It was to shut down Immigration Customs Enforcement and to really send a message that, here they are making these announcements where you have people who have had no criminal records, or people who represent no threat whatsoever, who are being picked up, and they're destroying families and having a huge impact, not just on the family, but on the community. And that, our message is that, to President Obama, that if he's not going to shut down these ICE operations, then the families and the community are. And this is a movement across the country to really call on him to use his executive authority to stop these deportations and provide even a temporary form of legalization till we can actually get the kind of reform we've been waiting for so long.
Christine, before we go to his daughter, can you tell us Manuel Lopez's story?
Manuel Lopez is one of those examples of a good family man who, you know, who is really a role model. I mean, he's someone who in the past did have a drug charge, and when he was a young guy, this is more than 10 years ago, and who paid his dues and learned his lessons and turned his life around. You're talking about something that a charge that happened when he was a young guy 10 years ago, and he is one of, you know, his niece, his brother, his daughter, both Destiny and her cousin are 11 years old. I mean, they have a loving family, and he's a good provider, and he's someone who's actually a role model because he's someone who showed how, you know, you can make mistakes in life and turn your life around, and that's the person who's wrongly being labeled, and they are destroying a family both economically, emotionally, and really they're denying this person his freedom. I mean, he is still being held in detention, and he's a case, as others around the country that we believe are being, don't represent any kind of threat and whose deportation cases should be closed. And these are people who should be reunited with their family because they don't represent any kind of priority. And in fact, all they do is create more fear within the community to work with law enforcement.
And Christine, we've got Manuel's daughter, Destiny Lopez, on the line. Destiny, were you there when your dad was arrested?
Yes, I was there. It was the day after Memorial Day, and he was taking us to school, and they came and they took him in front of all of us.
And have you heard from him since he was arrested?
Yes, I have. We have phone communication, but we have to pay like $10 a minute just to talk to him. And well, if we go visit, it's like through a glass door. You can't even touch him or hug him at all.
And what is the immigration status of the rest of his family?
We're all residents. We are my grandparents are citizens, and you know we're just trying to make a living here. You know, is that wrong for us to come here and you know to have a better life, to provide for our family?
Were you at the protest this morning, Destiny?
Yes, I was. I was there to support and to have justice.
And what do you hope people who hear about your protest, what do you want them to take away? What do you want them to know?
I want them to know that, you know, immigration isn't a crime, that we all deserve to be happy and united, to provide for our families, and, you know, that basically immigration isn't wrong at all. You know, whether you're trying to bring a case or, you know, the color of our skin or whatever it is, we all deserve to be united and be together equally.
Christine, a lot of people might feel sympathy for Manuel and Destiny and the whole family, but say he came here knowingly against United States law and should be subject to the consequences of that. What do you say, Christine?
Well, first of all, being undocumented is not a crime. It's a civil infraction. And I think there's a greater law, too, when you think about this country. And we can't forget that because it's not that many generations ago. This country has been built by generations of immigrants. And the American dream is about coming to the United States and trying to build a better life for yourself. These are people who are contributing positively. I mean, people who are contributing to our tax base. They're obviously working in many cases. You people who've been here, like the parents of the Dreamers who just recently were able to get temporary legal status. You know, their parents have been here for over 20 years. You know, they're seamstresses, they're janitors. We benefit from their labor. And I think it's right. We have a system that is dysfunctional, that it's discriminatory, that's very cruel. And I think, you know, what the crisis that we're in is that for so many years now, we've been fighting, certainly Voces has been fighting for over 10 years now for immigration reform. And though I know we are going to get there because the votes are there, and I think ultimately, inevitably, we're going to get there, but especially the closer we get to presidential elections and the Latino vote is, you know, very, very key. But in the meantime, we have a deportation machinery that has been set up, that set up under Bush, was expanded under Obama, and, you know, that has these arbitrary quotas and has a system that actually criminalizes people that in no sense of the word are any kind of threat. They're, in fact, they're people who are contributing positively. We don't gain by instilling fear in the community. We don't gain anything by leaving what is often the case, women who then, the head of household who provided is now gone, and leaving women in many cases now to try to find where are they going to pay the bills. I mean, that's what VOSIS does. We like have an emergency fund to, in whatever modest way we can, try to provide some emotional and financial support.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to Christine Newman-Ortiz, Executive Director of VOSIS de la Frontera, and to Destiny Lopez, daughter of Manuel Lopez, who was detained during a raid in late May. Time now for Curious Wisconsin, where we highlight interesting, unusual, and unique people and places around the state of Wisconsin.
In this edition, we go to Superior to visit a musical museum called A World of Accordions. It features over 1,300 accordions and related instruments and exhibits devoted to musicians and bands which featured the accordion.
Helmy Harrington is the owner and curator of A World of Accordions in Superior. Helmy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for allowing me to be part of this program.
Well, what will we see when we walk into the World of Accordions Museum?
Well, first, you should know that we're not only a local, but also a national and in many ways a world treasure. We are the single best accordion museum collection of instruments and their taxonomy in history anywhere. But you will see a breathtaking, eye-appeal, candy-like selection of 1,300 accordions on display. There are more in the building for varying displays, but you'll see all kinds of colors and designs, many more types of keyboard structures than anybody presumes is part of the family.
You mentioned the taxonomy. How much variety is there in the way accordions are designed and put together?
They were invented in 1829 by patent of Cyril Damian in Vienna. The instruments spread like wildfire throughout the world, and every country and every small place redeveloped, redesigned them to suit their own musical needs. So there are hundreds and hundreds of variations. No one has yet put together a complete taxonomy, and I've personally been working on one for 20 years, and it's still not complete.
Wow. And you've also got exhibits and tributes to a number of accordionists and bands that feature the accordion. Can you tell us about a couple of them?
Absolutely. Well, here the accordion is always popular throughout the world. It's one of the main distributors of folk music, legends, texts, body rhythms, dances, and traditions everywhere. So we have folk interests that are particularly strong since the 1980s, in which there was a rejuvenation of nostalgia throughout the United States. We have lots of pop music that results through and from that. So garage accordionists or garage bands add an accordion or a concertina. At least to the 75% of all, I am told. There are lots of rock and roll or pop bands that use them for periodic sound effects. And of course, the instrument is a concert instrument. So there are a number of not only entertainment and virtuoso groups, but very serious artistic performers that deal with the original repertory of the instrument, which is every bit as important to the world as Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms.
It's a really versatile instrument. It's kind of like a guitar in a way that it's portable, it can be a solo accompaniment to somebody singing, and it works really well with a band, too.
Well, this is true.
Now, tell us a little more about the museum. How long have you been there?
We have the museum was established about 25 years ago. We were first in Duluth, and we've been in Superior, Wisconsin for the last 12 plus years. The museum comprises not only the collection of accordions, but also a fabulous concert hall in which they are sounded and which has attracted performers from all over the world. We have library rooms that deal with reference materials and constructions of the instrument's history. We have about 1 million pieces of music that are accordion-related. For all of the members of the accordion family, we have catalogs, we have historic descriptions, we have reference materials, and we have the American Accordionist Association's archival collection, so that there is a presence in our building where people can view the social history of this major organization. Wow. We also have the Defner Legacy. We have some very specialized collection sites.
So you mentioned that you get musicians from all over the world. You also get researchers coming in to check out all those materials.
Thank you for asking. Yes, we've had at least 24 worldwide. We get national people and about 24 books or DVD documentaries have resulted from at least part of the studies that take place here.
Now, you are obviously someone who loves the accordion. What led you to that?
My mother and I emigrated from Germany after World War II, and it was how my mother made a living for us in Texas. She studied at the world's best accordion school and then made a living for our small family in Texas. I was interested in what she did, so even as a small child, was influenced by the accordion. I used the accordion to support myself all the way through 14 years of college. But by the time I was a teenager, my eyes went to a different direction, and I became a concert pianist, in addition to which, I earned a PhD in musicology. So nowadays, people don't argue too much about truth in references, but certainly the passion for music has been part of my life. And the knowledge of good and bad is present in that. Certainly also the love of making the music, which has spurred everything I've ever done.
With all the time you put into the museum, do you still have time to play and perform and teach music?
I have about 60 students a week.
Really? Wow.
In two locations, 200 miles apart. I play regularly in concerts and have done so with the symphony as well as in my own private environment here and elsewhere, as well as in national venues. So, yes, the love of making the music is what spurs and keeps it alive in my heart.
And if we visit World of Accordions, would we be able to talk you into doing a performance in your music hall there?
Oh, I wish you would. Yes, put me to the test. You see, I play all of the members of the accordion family, and so when I put on a demonstration, I'll play that which is folk, virtuoso, specific ethnic, like French musettes, as well as concert material and the transcriptions from the classics like Bach fugues or original music that was written for the accordion. Yes, I do all of it.
How important is the accordion as part of our cultural heritage here in Wisconsin in particular?
I think Wisconsin has a special basis for love in the instrument. We have many great performers that have established their lifespans here. I mean, Frankie Yankovic is certainly one. We have so many specific ethnic groups that have loved and promoted the accordion. I think we're in a very fortuitous place. But also, Wisconsin is in the center of the nation. There is no more perfect place to have some activity or important interest like we have for the accordion.
I've seen, it seems like, more and more people getting into accordions or the accordion family. I know my brother has picked up the concertina recently. Are we in the midst of an accordion renaissance?
Well, I'd like to say that there has never been a major decline because, you see, I've been in the accordion studio and business activities all my life, and it's always been big and important in my world. But I do think that there's truth to that. There are more people buying more instruments, more companies coming into existence, more distribution issues that seem to go not only nationwide, but worldwide. Helmy, so the groundswell is there again.
Helmy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ferret. I love the opportunity.
That was Helmy Harrington. She's curator of A World of Accordions Museum in Superior. First, a look at new research showing that fathers who shared in household chores are more likely, apparently, to have daughters with ambitious career goals.
Here to break down this research for us is Alyssa Croft, who is the lead author of the paper presenting these conclusions. She is a PhD candidate in social psychology at the University of British Columbia. Alyssa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you along. I want to start out with some background on how you got interested in this topic in the first place. What led you to pursue this?
Well, most of what we currently know about parents and children's gender role beliefs comes from studying stereotypes associated with the workplace rather than the domestic sphere. And so we know from prior research that despite efforts to create gender egalitarian workplaces, women are often more responsible for shouldering the burden of the domestic chores. And this is even true when both parents and a couple work full-time. And so we wondered whether this sort of traditional division of labor at home might have implications for how children's identities and gender beliefs are developing.
All right, so tell me a little bit about the study. How did you carry that out?
So to test this idea, we sampled 326 children and at least one of their parents, and we had them participate in the study while they were visiting the local science center in Vancouver, British Columbia. And we asked them a series of questions about their beliefs about gender roles. So who is more likely to put baby to bed? Who's more likely to cook dinner or do the laundry? And so they answered these questions about men and women in general. And then we asked them what their own division of labor looks like at home. And then for their children, we asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And then we sort of took all of this information together to see what predicted what kids would say.
So did you have a hypothesis going into this?
It's interesting to sort of think about this because we know, like I mentioned earlier from past research, that a lot of the beliefs that people have about gender and work are mirrored with sort of what those societal stereotypes are. And past research shows that mothers' beliefs about gender roles do tend to predict kids' beliefs about gender roles. But in terms of what kids actually aspire to be when they grow up, we weren't sure whether that would be more reflective of, you know, something that mothers do in the home or something that fathers do in the home. So this was kind of a surprising finding.
Yeah, so let's get to that. Your study essentially shows that fathers who help out with household chores are more likely to have those daughters with more ambitious career goals. How prevalent of an attitude was that in this study?
It's a great question. And I think, you know, in our sample, there was a very traditional slant so that, you know, women were doing significantly more of the household labor than men were. And, you know, we looked at this even controlling for the number of paid hours of work that each parent was doing per week. So overall, there does seem to be a pattern of this sort of traditional division of labor, second shift for women. But when we sort of break that down into a finer grained analysis, we see that for couples who are reporting, and fathers specifically, who are reporting that they do about 50-50 split of the domestic chores, then those are the dads with daughters who aspire to be more non-traditional careers for women.
And that's kind of an important distinction there, that the fact that the fathers are actually doing some of the work, because I read that there are a lot of fathers that talk the talk on this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we believe that women should be able to get ahead in the workplace and be in all these positions. But there, the attitudes don't really seem to change as much and translate into that ambition for girls.
Right. So what we're finding in our study is that, you know, overall attitudes, sort of beliefs about gender roles did predict what kids say they want to be when they grow up. But more importantly, it seems to be the behaviors that are carrying more weight. And so if girls are getting maybe discrepant messages at home, so maybe fathers are saying, you know, I'm for gender equality, I'm publicly espousing gender equality, but I'm not actually, you know, engaging in those behaviors, those observable behaviors that daughters can see, then it's more likely that, those daughters will aspire to more traditional sort of expectations for their own futures.
What about the impact on the boys in this study?
That also was a really interesting finding from this study, is that we didn't see that boys' career aspirations were being predicted by what their parents really said or did. And what we, you know, when we sort of looked at this more closely, what we saw was that boys were nominating very highly stereotypic career aspirations. So most of the boys in our sample are reporting wanting to be doctors, police officers, firefighters, scientists, very male-dominated types of careers. There weren't any boys who said they wanted to be teachers or librarians or social workers, anything that would be more classified as female. And so the idea here is that, well, maybe the messages that we're sending to boys as a society is just that their roles are much less rigid, or much more rigid, I should say, than girls' roles. So we're not giving them that same cue that, oh, you can be anything you want to be.
Interesting. So why do you think there's such a strong tie between the way that fathers act at home and then the way the daughters perceive gender roles?
Well, again, we don't want to sort of overinterpret these patterns of correlations. The you know, exact mechanism for what's going on here is still unclear and requires some future research. But one thing that we can speculate that might be going on here is we know from past research that men are afforded higher status in society. And so one possible thing that could be going on is that fathers are communicating what they believe is appropriate behavior for women and for their daughters more specifically.
So let's talk a little bit about applying this research. How would you apply this to a household where the mother might stay at home and then the father works? I mean, is it possible to those for those parents to actually promote gender equality, where, or does the father really have to, even though he might be working and the mother's doing most of the work, make special efforts in this regard to do stuff that's visually that the daughter can see at home?
Yeah, you know, and I don't know if there's anything that I can say that will directly speak to this, because again, it's, you know, we don't want to overinterpret the findings that we do have. But I mean, I really think that it couldn't hurt to have, you know, even parents where they've divided the labor, you know, intentionally in this way, to even just have, you know, fathers help out once in a while. I think it could make a difference. Even just, you know, letting girls observe that it's not just that these tasks are for women and these tasks are for men, you know, sort of almost blurring those boundaries a bit couldn't hurt, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, and that's one of the questions I should have asked you before. And in terms of when you say that it helps bolster the ambitions of daughters or the aspirations, talk a little bit about what that means, maybe like what a traditional role or an ambition might have looked like 20 or 30 years ago, and how that might differ from what an ambition might look like today for a girl.
Yeah, absolutely. So within the past, you know, several decades, since about the time of World War II, women's roles have been changing very, very quickly. And so it used to be that, you know, this sort of traditional division of labor was like what you were just talking about, with breadwinning fathers and caregiving mothers. And there was, you know, these very separate domains based on gender. And that's becoming less and less clear nowadays as women enter the previously male-dominated workforce. And so what we're sort of looking at in the bigger picture is this asymmetry between how much gender roles are changing for women and how much they're kind of not changing for men. And so, you know, we're telling little girls and women that the sky's the limit. You can be anything you want to be. But for men, there's still, you know, we're still putting men and boys in these very strict boxes of what is appropriate behavior. And so, you know, for example, if girls want to play with engineering toys, for example, there's Goldie Blocks are this new sort of toy that's engineering based and it's marketed towards girls. But there's no sort of similar, you know, if boys want to play with dolls or if they want to play house or play with kitchen things, they're sort of more admonished and given, you know, given a hard time as compared to what girls are able to do.
You know, one of the flip side of that, though, as you were talking about that, I was thinking sort of about the changing role of the family structure, whether you're talking about more single parent families or maybe same sex parents, that sort of thing. And it sounds like this study didn't address that, but it also sounds like there's lots more things to think about when we're talking about these.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this study is really just a drop in the bucket in terms of how far we can go in exploring these questions because, yeah, you're absolutely right. In this study, we looked only at heterosexual cohabiting parent couples. And so, just to really get some traction on what could be going on here. But it's absolutely true that there are many different avenues. And like you said, family structures are changing drastically. And so looking at sort of how that's playing a role and what that's sort of predicting in terms of children's identity development is a great next step for this research.
So speaking of next steps, how do you hope that the research you've completed, well, two questions, how has it been received so far? And then what do you hope it's going to lead to next?
Well, it's been received very well. I mean, in terms of just people sort of caring about these findings, it's very topical right now to be talking about work-life balance and this whole, you know, question of can we have it all and trying to maintain some semblance of our past while also transitioning to our futures. And I think that makes this topic really ripe for conversation right now. And so generally, people have been very interested in and fairly receptive to these ideas, but there is just so much more that needs to be done to really unpack what the process is and what's going on psychologically. And if it's the case that, you know, that dads are having this impact on daughters, right now it's just sort of a link that we're seeing. So there's so much to be done going forward.
So it sounds like you've got plenty to do in the next couple of years.
Yes. Definitely.
All right. Alyssa, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Alyssa Croft, a PhD candidate in social psychology at the University of British Columbia.
And we want to find out how this works out in your life. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a post there. How does housework get divvied up in your family? Growing up, what did you see from your parents? And do you think that had an impact on your life? Again, head over to the Central Time Facebook page and answer that question. Gene, the division of labor in your household, can I put you on the spot?
You can.
And what is it?
I refuse to answer that question on the grounds that it may tend to incriminate me.
Well, I do a lot of the dishes in my house, and my daughters have really, over the years, you know, race car driver, a lot of the boy stuff. Currently, of course, World Cup soccer star for some reason. I don't know what's putting that in their heads.
Well, we've only got cats at our house.
And do they aspire to greater things based on your level of housework?
They aspire to food twice a day is what they aspire to.
Inspirational, and, really.
Yeah.
First, a court ordered the unsealing of documents in the ongoing John Doe investigation. In some of the documents released today, it appears that prosecutors were investigating the governor's role in what they say is illegal campaign coordination. WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach is covering the story, and he joins us now from our Milwaukee studio. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon.
Well, what is new in these documents that were unsealed today?
Well, these documents came out as a federal appeals judge in Chicago is reviewing the federal case as to whether the John Doe 2 case should be halted. And the judge, Easterbrook, agreed to release about 250 pages of documents today, emails and other items, that really hammer home what many have alleged, and many Democrats have alleged, that Governor Walker was seen as the alleged centerpiece of the coordination effort, the fundraising effort between conservative groups and his campaign in the 2012 recall elections, also involving the state Senate recall elections in 2012 and 2011, I believe.
And that's the new bit. We had understood all along that it seemed like this investigation was looking at Governor Walker's campaign and those outside groups you mentioned, but it wasn't clear if Governor Walker himself was under investigation by the prosecutors. Am I right on that?
Technically, yes, although, as I say, sort of people have been following this sort of say, well, the governor was the head of his campaign, was he not? He must have known something about it. And again, these are allegations mm-hmm. that he did know and did coordinate. And there's emails, including one to Karl Rove, that adds some more fuel to the speculation.
What did he say in that email? That's one that's been that people have been pulling out of this this story so far.
Right. He wrote in, Governor Walker wrote in May 2011 to Karl Rove, the former Bush aide and still GOP strategist, briefly quoting, it says, bottom line, Walker says, RJ, that's RJ Johnson, Wisconsin Club for Growth, helps keep in place a team that is wildly successful in Wisconsin. We're running 9 recall elections. Then it'll be like 9 congressional markets in every market in the state. And Twin Cities. So, the appearance is Walker contacting Karl Rove to talk about what's been going on as far as fundraising and coordination, and maybe it was a pitch for more funds from outside groups. Maybe it was just saying, "Listen, we got it." So that's the allegation.
And the illegal bit there is that under state law, I believe it is. You can correct me if I'm wrong there. If I'm a candidate, I cannot directly coordinate spending, advertising, any activities with outside groups.
Well, that's, you know, that's the central issue, put it that way. The federal courts have been starting to gray things up a little, if you will, and make it a little muddy as to what is legal and what's illegal and that sort of coordination. But the prosecution got started, or the investigation got started, with the belief that that sort of coordination was not legal under Wisconsin law.
There was some drama leading up to the unveiling of these documents, some kind of challenge to the unsealing of the documents today. What was the story there, do you know?
Well, I think there were groups that are interested that wanted to keep things behind closed doors or behind in a file drawer or, I guess, in a computer somewhere locked away. But again, the appeals court judge said, let's let these out and let's see what's let the public see what's in them. Governor Walker was in Milwaukee this afternoon at an event, a water summit, and talked to reporters afterwards. He said, listen, you know, federal Judge Randa in Milwaukee has halted the investigation. Earlier, the state judge helping oversee John Doe, too, limited who could be quizzed and some of the information. And Walker saying, listen, neither of these judges I had any hand in appointing or anything, they have said that the case has not been made against me. So he was never asked, Governor, did you break the law? But he never said that he broke the law either. He just said that he didn't break the law. He just said, listen, the judges have said this hasn't risen to a prosecutable crime against me.
I'm guessing this was maybe of more interest to reporters gathered there than the water summit itself?
Well, that and the job, well, but we were also interested in the jobs report, which is making news today about Wisconsin gaining jobs, but still ranking last in the Midwest, or at least relatively low in the Midwest. So the governor had to answer questions about that as well.
Now, you mentioned that the John Doe investigation is currently on hold after Judge Randa's ruling. Where does that stand now? It's in Judge Easterbrook's hands, is that right?
Well, it's at the appellate level in Chicago, and, it's hard to – the prosecutors, I think, have suggested to let them sort of finish the job. State Democrats have also – are today calling for the case to be unlocked, if you will, and let it play its course. It's just risen to the level of national news, of course, NPR, and as far as media and AP and so on. And the Democratic National Committee is saying it's time for the governor to come clean with the people of Wisconsin and face the consequences.
One big change here today, the whole concept of the John Doe investigation is a certain level of secrecy and behind closed doors. Now a lot of the investigation so far is out in the open. Does that change how people are talking about it, how it would proceed if it got back on the rails?
Well, put it this way. The governor was asked today, here you are in a 2014 reelection campaign against presumed Democratic candidate Mary Burke. What do you say to voters? How are they supposed to look at this? And the governor was saying, look, they should look at no one's been charged, mm-hmm. What I'm trying to do is create jobs in the state and go from there. So But it does make things, it would seem, more difficult for the governor as he continues to campaign, although polls have said voters have not placed a lot of importance on the John Doe lately. Maybe this will change that in their minds.
And this, at least based on the response I've seen so far on Twitter and in email press releases, reaction to this seems to be split on partisan lines. You mentioned state and national Democrats putting out press releases saying this is a sign of wrongdoing for the governor. And a lot of response saying, well, this is allegations, as you mentioned, but also politically motivated from the prosecutors. This isn't going to be settled as a partisan dispute anytime soon, is it?
Well, although in the Democrats, though, do point out that the special prosecutor, Francis Schmitz, is a Republican, and he's the one that wrote the in the documents, the scope of the criminal scheme under investigation is expansive. So Democrats are saying it's not just a partisan witch hunt or a fishing trip or whatever, but that it's a bipartisan look at what the governor is alleged to have done.
Looking ahead, any sense on when that appellate court that determines the future of this John Doe 2 investigation, any sense when they might come out with a decision?
I don't think it's real clear, but they're, about 4.5 months before the election. I would assume some more would come out between now and November 4th.
We'll leave it there for now. Chuck, thanks for joining us.
Yep.
That was WPR reporter Chuck Quirnbach.